This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Okay, is the machine on?
It is now.
Thomas
McIntyre.
Sorry.
I've been looking at your name in magazines.
Don't tell me how long.
Well, my entire life I've been looking at your name in magazines.
You were very precocious, eh?
How many, I don't know, it feels like my entire life. How many magazine articles have you written? Thousands.
No, not thousands. No, hundreds, maybe. You know, I've written. The last few years, I've probably written more television shows. I'm not a very fast writer. I'm a half fast writer.
You ever hear that quote from? I think it was R.W. Apple. Had that quote that I can write faster than anyone who can write better than me, and I can write better than anyone who can write faster than me.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I probably am good for 20 articles a year, feature articles a year.
What do you mean writing television shows?
I write for Trev Gowdy, for Sasquatch Mountain Man and his Monster Fish show.
Write what?
I write the script.
Like enter animal. Enter.
No, it's like. And now, as the deer comes towards Jim.
Oh, you write the narration.
Yeah, the voiceover.
So you're coming in after the cut's been put together.
Yeah. And I have one of those charming little golden mices in my house, too.
What's that mean?
The golden moose.
Oh.
Oh.
Like an award.
Yeah. It's like you got on your shelf over here.
Yeah. And for what? For narration?
For writing. For his fishing show. They decided.
They'll make the show. And then they'll send it to you, and you'll be like, and there'll be some scratch VO, and you'll go in and redo. You'll write like what's going to be the actual narration. Do you do the read on it?
No. They have a professional talent for that. No, I get scratch VO. Yeah, well, no, not necessarily.
There's no scratch VO in
it. No, it could be like right here. That's it. You know,
yeah.
It's give us 15 seconds here about what. Well, whatever you know.
Whatever. Do you like doing it?
Okay. Let, aside from the fact that it's easy money,
yeah,
which I don't want anybody to know.
Well, there's going to be two or three now.
You know. Well. it's a different muscle. It's a different deal. You know. Some are better than others. I mean, some are better to work on than others.
Yeah.
Not the shows per se, but just individual episodes, you know. I can tell when they're scrambling.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys know what that's like.
Oh yeah.
You know.
It's got a certain smell to it.
Yeah. What is it Bourdain talks about smells like stinky feet.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So you grew up reading Hemingway? Could you talk a lot about Hemingway in your book?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think that was more like, I had a high school teacher who was like just a Hemingway guy in the 60s. And I started reading it. But I also my influences are also personal.
Well, because you don't, here's the thing.
Yeah.
You don't write like an outdoor writer.
What does that mean?
Well, you write like a writer.
Okay,
there's outdoor writers.
Yeah.
Right. Now, there's some aspects of outdoor writing in your writing that a writer would never think to do.
Right.
Courtesies, where you'd be like, instead of I lifted old Bessie,
right,
you might be like, I lifted X caliber make and model firearm.
Dawn was a Primrose Promise.
Which is a outdoor writer thing to do, that a writer wouldn't do unless, like, Cormac McCarthy would do it, but it wouldn't be the same. It just would be different. Well, no, I should say it, because Cormac McCarthy in No Country for Old Men does even say like someone had a 9mm Parabellum or whatever, right?
Right, right.
So yeah, so some writers do clarify calibers and grain bullets and whatnot, but generally you don't write like an outdoor writer. Because there's people, here's the way I'm putting it. There's people that were going to be writers.
I was going to be a writer.
Okay, they're going to be writers. They're like, I'm going to be a writer. I don't know what exactly I'm going to write about. That'll come out in time, but this is what I'm doing. And yeah. Then you got people who were, I'm going to do something in the outdoor industry. Not sure what it is. It'll emerge over time. And those two people have very different world views when they each wind up being an outdoor writer.
And I guess in my case, there was a mesh of the two, an intersection where I was influenced as a young child into hunting, which was unusual because I grew up in like L.A.
Because your old man didn't hunt.
No. But the guy I learned from was his friend. And I talk about it in the book. I mean, why am I writing about Africa at, you know, at this late date?
What do you mean late date?
It is a late date. I mean, you know,
you mean like in your life.
No, I think I think that the whole for the parameters around African writing have changed a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a time when it was, as I think I say somewhere in the book, I mean, the greatest adventure money could buy.
Okay, let's pause for a minute.
Pause.
Because you've recently published the book August in Africa.
Right. Yeah.
So I just want people to be aware, and this book just came out, or not, like within a year or so, or what?
Yeah, within 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some of these pieces you wrote long ago.
They're 40 years old, some of them.
Yeah.
I started.
So to collect it, so you're saying, like, Africa writing has changed between when you began.
Africa's changed from when I began.
To when you're now putting this out in book form.
Yeah. African hunting has changed.
Like, because of Cecil the Lion?
No. I don't think so. I think Cecil is the least of the worries.
Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know that there's any way of putting that particular genie back in the bottle. That's been going on since Born Free, you know?
Yeah.
You know, back in the 60s. It's been going on for ages.
Can we hold off on this for a second?
Sure.
So your old man didn't hunt. You were born in LA.
Yeah.
He had a buddy that hunted.
And went to Africa in the 50s.
Oh.
On very little money.
Was your dad a writer?
No, my dad was a machinist. And actually, he and his brother owned a company.
So who was the first writer you knew?
You mean?
Like, what made you aware that there's a thing called writers and that you could be one?
You know, these are wonderfully probing questions. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I had a certain facility for words, you know, which is, as I get older, is fleeting away.
Mm-hmm.
But really? Thank you.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying because I feel like it's happened to me and then comes back again, though.
But in some ways, it's like my fastball's not there anymore, but I'm learning. I've got a lot more, you know, sliders and fork balls and stuff. I can, my technique has gotten better.
Really?
I think so. I like to think so anyway.
Those are terms for tricky, baseball pitches.
Yeah, I know. I'm educated enough in sports.
Oh, you
stuff
are?
Like that. When right. someone says like fastball, I'm tracking.
You track one
yeah.
sport?
Yeah. You know.
Well, maybe not all our listeners, you know, aren't huge baseball fans.
Right. Well, anyway, I mean, if I'm going to be totally autobiographical, it was the nuns. It was the nuns in grammar school that they singled me out and they said, you can write.
Is that right?
Yeah. And that was like, and like, I think like anything else, it was like, this was a wonderful way to get attention. you know?
Yeah, I'm with you.
And
it's funny when you go, when you need to express the thing, like what caused something.
Yeah.
Because it's like a game you could play. Like, you know, like I'll often say like, yeah, I kind of wish I hadn't done my first book the way I did it. My wife's like, well, we wouldn't have met. Because I'm like, okay, but that's like that old story where the guy goes back in time to hunt a dinosaur and steps on a butterfly, and they find a dinosaur that's about ready to die anyway, and he's really careful.
Yeah,
and while he's shooting the dinosaur, he steps on a butterfly and comes back, and the Nazis won World War II.
And Trump is president.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, sorry.
So you do get into like what made it become you became a writer.
Right.
And it's a hard thing. I've kind of like, I look and I'm like, it's kind of because of my 10th grade English teacher, Robert Heaton.
Sure.
Kind of like, if I had to go like, well, that, right?
Right. And as far as the Hemingway thing, I'll get put a plug in for my sophomore English teacher at the, you know, with the Jesuits, was Tom McCambridge, who's still around, who still talk. But I knew about hunting before I knew about Hemingway.
Uh-huh.
Except, well, that's not really true, because I think this is very weird. I mean, and I don't know how these things happen. I was 7 or 8 years old, and I was riding with my father in his, I think it was a Buick Wildcat, 1961. And we were turning down this street called Cherokee in Downey, California. And the radio news came on and said, author Ernest Hemingway is dead. And this was in the summer of that year. And I really had no idea who he was. I was 7 years old. And then fast forward into high school, and this other, you know, this strange serendipity of, you know, forces coming together, whatever. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think that was part of it. I think there was that allure of being, what kind of writer is this guy, Hemingway? You know, I mean, he can write about, you know, he can write about stuff, he can do stuff, he knows about stuff. I mean, I think there's a great line that ultimately, you know, what writers have to know something.
Yeah.
You know? And he knew. I mean, you know, he knew how to dig worms and go fishing in the big two-hearted river, you know, which doesn't exist, I don't think. Or does it?
You would a little too hard.
Yeah. So I mean it's I mean he like fumble with the directions, or am on purpose to kind of like, you know,
make you ever sure. Fish that river?
No.
I haven't either.
Then you mean like the Nick Adams stories?
Yeah. I mean he fudged the directions. So if you follow them, you'd never find the place.
You'd never find it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't going to tell you where his particular hole
formed of you. Yeah, grew up in Illinois. Now, when he shot himself.
Yeah.
Ketchum, Idaho. With a shotgun, I believe, was purchased from Abercrombie & Fitch.
It was a Boss 10-gauge with dual triggers.
But didn't it wind up being, there's a thing that happened not long ago. His family took the shotgun down to have a mechanic destroy it.
Well, he took a cutting torch and cut the hole. This is in Sylvia Calabrese. That's the guy's, Hemingway's guns.
Yep.
And they did this.
And he went and buried it, and they never found it. But he took a couple pieces, like the trigger,
right?
And put it in a matchbox.
A little piece of the side lock.
Yeah, put it in a matchbox.
And they're able to go back and piece it all together.
Because it had always been thought that he had shot himself with some different shotgun. It turned out that the pieces in that matchbox was from a different shotgun than whatever he thought he killed himself with.
Yeah.
Now, you know you're something special when people will later argue about what gun it was that you killed yourself with.
Yeah. Yeah.
But more than Hemingway, like, I feel like when you write, I don't think you don't write like Hemingway. I don't think you like try to write like Hemingway. But the stuff you wrote in the 70s sounds, it reminded me a lot of like other guys that write in the 70s, even where like early Jim Harrison, early Tom McGuane.
God.
And it kind of reminded me like the structure of the stuff.
Well, yeah.
A disjointed structure that also reminded me of the other guy that shot himself in Big Sur, California, Richard Brautigan.
Yeah.
Did you read all those guys? Or was it just something in the air?
No, I read all those guys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, that was the idea that you could actually be a, I think one of McGuane's favorite words, a sportsman.
Yeah.
You know, and actually write about it. I had no interest in, well, I didn't live in that milieu anyway. I was never going to write about Manhattan. Mm-hmm. You know, I was never going to write the Jay McInerney kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't going to write novels anyway, as it turned out. Though I do have one novella, but anyway,
the Snow Leopard's Tale.
Yeah. And, Alan Jones,
not the Snow Leopard,
Snow Leopard's Tale, which yeah. was
not T-A-I-L.
No, T-A-L-E. It was what we finally came with. Alan Jones over at Bangtail Press, yeah. right here in town. And he says, hello. That's what we came up with. So anyway, yeah, you know, I mean, it was, yeah, that stuff was out there, and that was where you'd looked, you know, that was the way it was. Somehow I had this notion that you could actually make it as a writer and not have to get sucked into academia
mm-hmm.
or someplace else.
One of my, this apropos, you know what people say, like, speaking of which, or like, let's say you're talking about frogs, you know, and you're like, yeah, frogs are generally, a lot of frogs are green. And then someone will say, speaking of frogs, and then I'll tell you something about frogs.
Yeah.
I find myself a lot of times in conversation, like, wanting to raise a point that I can't even say speaking of which. But, like, it's not even related to what we're talking about. But a favorite thing of mine about Tom McGuane.
Speaking of
McGuane. He writes great short stories still to this
Michelle's
day.
Michelle's favorite writer.
McGuane's your, oh, that's one right. Them, yeah. You haven't said anything yet.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Hi. I like Tom McGuane.
Yeah,
so,
I like Tom McGuane.
McGuane still writes, I mean, he writes phenomenal short stories.
Oh, yeah.
There's two short story writers I like right now. I like Tom McGuane and I like a girl named Curtis Sittenfeld.
Don't know her.
Yes. Yeah.
Really? Pieces in New Yorker.
Dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
She is good. Huh. So, McGuane, he's got an essay he wrote about hunting. And it's like a 70s style essay.
Well, it wasn't the 70s.
Everybody's essays in the 70s all were kind of the same. It's just good versions mm-hmm. of bad versions of it. Like pasta, right? Like spaghetti with meat sauce. You look at it and say, like, oh, you know, spaghetti and meat sauce. There's something that's good, there's something not. Essays in the 70s looked a certain way. His were the good version.
Well, it was.
And
it was,
he's got this piece he wrote where in it he's imagining a conversation. I talk about this all the time. He's imagining a conversation between a hunter and an anti-hunter. And the anti-hunter is taking the hunter to task.
Right.
And they're like, why do you have to kill deer? What did deer do to you? And the hunter's like, I can't talk about it this way.
Right.
And they're like, no. Why do deer have to die for you? Would you die for a deer? And he says, if it came to that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is, in circles and a spiral and a wheel within a wheel. No, it's the like his editor for that piece was Terry McDonald, who coincidentally later became my editor at Sports Afield.
Got you. I know that. Yeah, that's the
and then name. He and you know and then his I took Terry out on an antler. Well, I went back to New York and I was saying, like, you're editing an outdoor magazine. I said, yeah. He says, you ever hunted anything? And he goes, no.
He's like, does that matter?
Yeah. Yeah. I said, yeah, it matters. And I said, come out to Wyoming and we'll hunt antelope with black powder rifles. And he said, okay. So, you know, we came out and, you know, he was out in this blind, I guess, and this antelope walked by and he killed it very, you know, serviceably. And then I was walking out to them and I got up to him and he was like looking at me and he said, you know, Tom, I saw you cross in the field. I said, yeah. And I suddenly had this urge to shoot and kill you. And I said, really, Terry? He said, yes. Yes, I did. Anyway, that evening went on for quite a little while. And the next morning he had to catch a plane and I had to come in and wake him up and ask him what he wanted for breakfast. And he said, I'll have the surfer breakfast. And I go, the surfer breakfast? And he goes, yeah, Twinkie and a Pepsi.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, but he actually commissioned that piece by McGuane.
The McGuane piece.
Yeah. And it was actually McGuane went to him. He said, I want you to, he was starting Outside. And he said, I want you to write a piece for Outside. And McGuane said, I don't suppose you'd want something about hunting. And he goes, well, it's not really kind of where we're at, but sure.
Yeah. I've wedged a number of hunting stories into Outside over the years.
There you go.
You got to cram them in there, but if you try hard enough, you can stick it in there. Now, there's a thing you say in your book that really surprised me. I want to make sure that you think this is correct. That Africa has a lower percentage of what one would call wilderness than does the world in general.
Supposedly. Those are the statistics that
I guess it kind of makes sense if you think about
semantics.
The circumpolar boreal, like
they are the Antarctic. You know, but the other figure that's more interesting, I think, is that there is more wilderness in North America than there is in Africa.
But
you have to realize that the Africans are essentially pastoralists and agrarians. So they are, you know, they are, and there's a billion of them, you know, there's a billion Africans.
Yeah.
And they tend to be spread out. You know, it's, if you took off of here and went up in the mountains someplace and were walking around, you would be surprised to run into somebody, you know? You could, but I mean, there is almost no place in Africa where you will not run into somebody. They'll be on foot. They may be carrying a spear. They may be driving a cow. They may be doing whatever, you know, but that tempers the definition of wilderness, you know? So it is more of, I mean, it is a rural society more than a wilderness society. The wilderness society.
Is that a product possibly of maybe the landscape or the people requiring a larger piece of the landscape?
They have to live. Exist? They have to live.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Val Geist up in BC.
We talk about that guy every day.
Yeah, I love him. He's a great guy. yeah, Val. Anyway, so Val would like, you know, Val is like, well, I was asking him, I said, what'll produce more biomass? And he goes, well, you got to remember African is, as he says, thin soils. They didn't have the advantages of glaciers pushing all this topsoil down like we have here. And so we have a much more fertile base, as it were, that you can grow a lot less in Africa than you can here. And because of that, the people tend to be more spread out.
Yeah.
And so they're
it's like how cows are spread out.
Yeah.
If you go look at like grazing ratios in Florida.
Yeah.
Cows per acre.
Yeah.
I mean, look at cows per acre in West Texas. It takes a hell of a lot more ground.
I mean, if you want to raise cattle, you go to Iowa and you feed them silage, you know. That's the sensible way of doing it.
Yeah. You ever see a map of where you could raise cattle without supplemental feed?
No, but I'm pretty sure it's fascinating.
It's not a big chunk of ground.
No. It's like, you know, it's how much corn is raised for cattle.
Yeah.
So,
that really threw me for a loop. And I should clarify, like, I've never stepped foot on Africa. I've always been kind of interested in going there. And I've come kind of close sometimes to going there hunting, but I have so many things about it give me pause, mm-hmm. and I'll ask you about a lot of those things.
Sure.
But
sure.
I'm coming at you in discussing this, not from an educated perspective. I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, oftentimes I have the luxury of talking to people about shit I already know about.
That doesn't stop a lot of people from.
No, but I feel like what doesn't happen is a lot of people don't lay that out.
Up right, front. Right. Well, that's an admirable position.
Yeah. You talk in your book, and this might be a good way to kind of lay out like when you started going there, how many times you've been there. Yeah. You talk in your book at a point where you say there's old school African hunting,
yeah,
and there's new school African hunting.
Right.
what are they, and when did it tip?
Well, I think I can't deny that there are probably aspects of what I kind of think of as old school. Let's put it this way. When I first started going to Africa 40 plus years ago,
when you were in your 20s.
Yeah. It was, when I first started going there, we would go to the game department and we would get licenses and permits. It wasn't just complete, you know, laissez-faire. And
the permits were expensive or inexpensive?
Well, no, relatively speaking, it depends on where you were, you know. I mean, I guess they were expensive at the time, but I had
So it wasn't like buying like elk tags as a resident or like buying a deer tag as a resident in Florida.
I mean, it was, let's put it this way. I mean, it has certainly become exponentially more expensive from what it was.
It's ahead of inflation.
Yeah. What it was in those days was probably not considered cheap. I had the benefit. I had some money that I had gotten, and I had enough money to either, let's say, go put a down payment on a house or go to Africa.
This is the first time you went.
Yeah.
You didn't go as a writer.
No, I wasn't published.
I got you.
So I just went. It was like, what are you going to do when you get back? You know, this is my question more than anything else. And I didn't have an answer. I mean, I didn't know. Well, I guess I'll come back and try to write about something.
Okay.
You know, but I, for some reason, because of my experience of a friend of my father's, his influence on me, you know, too many books read at too young an age, I wanted to go. I wanted to see it.
That's a quote in your book.
I guess.
Where Hemingway, what Hemingway book was that? Where one of the characters says, hey, we should go to Africa and go hunting. The other character's like, never had any desire. He goes, that's just because you haven't read a book about it.
that's from The Sun Also Rises.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, they, I mean, it's the, you know, it, what was I going to say? When I went there, you were mobile. You moved, you know, we would go into an area and we would find a spot and we'd go, you know, under the fever trees and we would put the tents up and then we would hunt. And
not hunting, these aren't fenced areas.
Oh God, no. No.
Just
No.
When you say we, who is we?
Well, I'd have a professional hunter. You know, that would just be the two of us.
Two of you.
And the track. That's another thing I mentioned in the book. I mean, because basically you have, you know, it's a polite fiction that the professional hunter is there for. You know, but the guys who are really doing the work are the trackers because they are so good at what they do.
They are.
But in those early days, though, it was still you, professional hunter, and multiple trackers.
Yeah.
The professional hunter is like a liaison.
He's a legal requirement, but he's also more than that.
But it's not a legal requirement that he be white.
No. And I've hunted with black professional hunters.
Okay.
You know, who are great guys. I mean, you know.
Native born.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I guess most of the white professional hunters. Well, no, you mentioned a lot were born in England and elsewhere.
Not necessarily. No. Oh. I mean, some of them, you know, the first guy hunted with John Fletcher, he was actually born in India.
Okay.
But he was a colonialist, I guess, without any pejorative attachment to that word.
Yeah.
But he was with Kerr, Downey, and Selby, you know, and this is kind of the way it was in those days is, I found a night. I knew the name Curran Downey,
which is an outfitter.
Yeah, it was like Robert Rourke, you know, and those guys hunted with Curran Downey, and then Harry Selby is the guy who was Rourke's professional hunter.
Yanni likes that guy Rourke,
and he put in with these two guys, and they became Curran Downey and Selby Safaris.
Yeah,
and I actually knew the name. I had no other information on them, and a friend of mine had gone to Nairobi, and he'd come back with the phone book. He'd stolen the phone book because he thought it was pretty cool to have a the Nairobi phone book. And I looked it up. I got their name and address out of the thing, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, I want to go hunt with you guys. And this letter came back with all these blue lions on the outside of the letter going, we'd love to have you come hunt with us. Please do. And so that's how I got over there. You know, now, of course, today you're going to go to like the conventions and you're going to go to a booking agent and you're going to, you know, you're going to, it's yeah. all, it's all going to be brokered for you. It's all going to be negotiating. Anyway, that's the way it is. I'm not one of those kind of guys who like says, well, that's, you know, that makes it all bad. It's just the way it makes it the way it is.
Yeah.
But, so when I first went there and it was still this holdover of the kind of some of the worst aspects of colonialism. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. The way I hunted in Kenya at that time, I mean, this is the way that people had been hunting for 70, 80 years, you know, and it was the way.
What was the way? Like, what's the structure?
It was the structure, the organization, you know, the fact that you were going into an area and you were hunting, you know, we were the.
But what was colonial? Because it was exploitative of the.
Well, it was a skin color was you know
a factor
a factor.
You mean in compensation, hierarchy?
No, it was just the way it was.
But I'm saying it was a factor in what?
It was the way the safari system had been structured, and evolved from, you know, like Roosevelt on. Is you had a professional hunter with a licensed hunter, and then it was, you know, he would set up the camps and he had responsibility, and it was, you know, what they wanted to make sure was that when the Mzungu, the crazy white guy who's going over here to hunt, he's not going to get killed. Okay. We don't want him to be killed.
Because that's going to look bad.
It's not going to be good for our tourist industry.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the first time Hemingway went to Tanzania or Tanganyika in those days, that was on his own dime, or at least his wife's uncle's dime, you know, and it was a pretty expensive deal in those days. If you figure it out, it's not cheap. When he went back the second time to Kenya for, I don't know how long, months, he was there as the guest of the Kenyan game department.
Okay.
Because they wanted, we would love to have some promotion to get people here to, you know, we're kind of on the cusp of the Mau Mau uprisings and we're getting some bad press and we want to, you know, we would love to have you come in here and you know, hang around. And so that's what he was.
I got to stop because I feel like I'm missing something.
Sure.
The first time you went.
Yeah.
You go there and there's a feller, the PH.
Right.
He's a white guy.
Right.
And there's some element of he's a colonial. Being that yeah. European countries carved up Africa.
Right.
And they had colonies.
Yeah.
And there was a offset power structure
right.
that favored those white individuals or the indigenous individuals that lived there.
Well, it was an economic. Yeah.
And also hunting with you are trackers.
The trackers are there as, you know, they're working for, they are hired by the professional hunter.
And you say they do the heavy lifting of the hunting.
They're the guy you put them on a track and they're going to figure out where that track ends up.
To a degree where you're like, holy shit, this guy's good at tracking.
Oh man. Oh man.
Like you wouldn't be able to do.
You know, that's the scary part. If you follow those guys around, even for a few weeks, you can begin to like actually, you know, kind of deceive yourself into figuring out, oh,
what it is they're doing.
Yeah. And you get to the point where you can like, look, oh, here's a buffalo track. Look how the edge is shiny. It's fresh. You know, it's not blown over, you know? So it was probably this morning. Let's go. Let's get on this track and go.
And you also mentioned how the coarseness of the vegetation
yeah.
in the buffalo shit
yeah.
giving you an indication of tooth wear.
Especially elephants. Elephants, you can look at, you can get the, you know, the elephant dung is like this basketball laying on the ground. And you can look at how coarse the grass stems are in it. That will tell you that it's an older bull because his teeth are worn down and he's not chewing it as much as he could
yeah.
as a younger one would. So that's an indication of something. It doesn't, you know, none of that tells you if you're elephant hunting. And I've never taken an elephant, although I would have maybe, but I never have. and I add the fact is that doesn't tell you how big the ivory is. You know, the size of the track doesn't tell you anything.
If it's got a big tusk or not.
No.
You know? All right. So, old school.
Yeah.
New school.
New school is now, okay.
Well, old school is, explain more about old school.
Okay, well, old school is essentially you were hunting as close to wilderness in Africa as you could find.
Okay.
You know, as we were talking about before, it was when, by the definition of wilderness in this country, probably wouldn't qualify. You know, there were motor vehicles allowed. You could, you know, but you were out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and it was, and you'd run across, you know, Maasai who were still, I mean, guys with spears. These guys were still spearing lions in those days.
Okay.
You know, and it was all essentially, it was government land, open land, wild land. It wasn't controlled by anybody.
You're just roaming around.
You had arranged for the right to hunt it for a certain amount of time. You know, and a certain perimeter. You know, they broke it up on what they called hunting blocks. And you would actually get block 60 and you would hunt block 60, which might be 250,000 acres. I don't know. I mean, it was just go on forever.
Yeah. And the PH arranged that with the government?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was, that's what they did. They'd go to the game department. Now, fast forward 30, 40 years.
To the new school.
New school. And you kind of get to the South African model. And the South African model, the land is owned by the hunter or by a landowner, and then the hunter, professional hunter, will like sort of lease that out.
Yep.
You know, and he'll bring in his clients, quote unquote clients, and they will. And it's
why been, quote unquote. Sorry.
Oh, I just there's there. It, you know, you get that. You get into that weird area. Like, am I a hunter? Am I a client? Am I not? You know, you go back and forth on that.
I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, you know, it's how much hand holding are you getting?
Okay.
You know, and
meaning a client gets more than a hunter.
Client is the term, I think, to avoid confusion with professional hunter. You know, that you are the client is a hunter. The professional hunter is the licensed guide on the hunt. So I think the term of art is client. You are the client of the professional hunter. Yeah.
But that would seem like a really literal, perfect word.
Client?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're giving the guy money to take you hunting. You're his client.
Yep. Yep. Same thing in this country when you go, you know.
Do you think
that's the word Giannis guided. He knows to talk about, he talks about clients.
Yeah.
Do you think guys go over there and then disliked being called clients because they wanted to be called
hunter? You know, I mean, there's you know, everybody wants to be Jungle Jim. You know, everyone wants to come back wearing, you know, as soon as they go, they want to run out and buy the safari jacket and the, you know, with the bullet holes or the pouches in the shirt.
So they aspire to be taken more seriously than they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and there's a great line I quote Jim Harrison in the book where he talks about that, you know, that, there's a certain amount of African hunting that, is really a polite fiction or a little comedy that wealthy sportsmen play on their less well-heeled brethren back home. You know, it's like they're always getting charged by a lion.
I'm with you.
Attacked by a Cape buffalo or something.
So, and then,
and there is a point to this that, so now it's like, you know, and God bless them. I mean, if you want to go to Africa, go to Africa. And if
God bless who?
Any hunter who wants to go to Africa.
Really?
If he wants to go to South Africa and he wants to shoot a kudu and a oryx and a whatever, you know, I don't feel bad about that because the meat is going to be used, every scrap of it.
But in the new school model, what's the main, I still don't understand the main difference.
Time. I think more than anything else, it's schedule and time. And if you go there,
they run it like a hunt factory
in some instances, in some cases, That doesn't mean you cannot find places in Africa that are not that, you know? And the more you, for lack of a better term, mature in your African hunting, the less interesting that kind of hunting becomes.
So sketch out that kind of hunting. Because can I tell you what I think? My impression.
Yeah.
Let's start with my impression based on nothing.
Sure.
And you tell me where I'm wrong.
Sure.
My impression of going to South Africa to hunt is you're hunting on fenced land.
Yeah.
And you go and you have a budget.
Yeah.
And they're like, you can shoot that and that's $5,000. You can shoot that and that's $8,000. And guys drive around in a truck and they're like, oh, no shit. That's what one of those looks like. Blam. And the guy's like, that's six. And he's like, well, I can only spend 20.
Yeah.
So let's go shoot some more shit till I get up to 14. And yeah. then I'm heading home.
Keep the tally going.
Is that wrong?
No. Oh, well, I mean, in the cosmic sense, yeah, it's really wrong. But I mean, in the sense of what you're going to, what the way things can be, and I want to make sure I make that clear, can be the experience many people go to Africa and come back and describe as their African hunt.
And that plays out over how many days?
How fast do you want to shoot them?
They're that abundant.
Depends on what the guy's got. You know, I mean, he's got, you know, he may have a run on Springbok this week.
So, what do you mean by that?
Well, he may go, I've got 1,000 acres of productive Springbok habitat.
Okay.
And I've got, that will support 50 Springbok. Or, you know, 100 Springbok.
And he puts them in there or they're there?
He's put them in there before they have bred.
Okay.
They are usually self-sustaining and breeding on their own, you know.
But they are cutting animals loose into there for people to go get.
No, the animal is there. You're just going inside to get it.
So it's not like the kind of canned hunt or fence hunt where they cut the animal loose in the morning.
No.
And you go shoot it that day.
No, they don't do that.
They don't do that in Africa.
No. Well, I can't say that.
It's a big place.
There may be places where that happens. I don't know that, you know. I mean, I've hunted behind fences, and it was okay, but I very quickly learned the difference.
You did, because you had started out in the wild roaming in the wild.
Yeah, and so whenever I could go back, you know, I haven't hunted in South Africa in 20 years.
Is South Africa kind of the center of the new school?
Yeah.
What remains the center of the old school?
Well, Tanzania. Tanzania is still
roaming around in the woods.
Yeah. And it's fabulously expensive.
Oh, it is.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's more expensive to roam around in the woods
dealing with
uncertainty than it is to not roam around and have certainty.
Absolutely.
So guys know the difference.
Because people pay for that experience, so you're saying.
They're that's the whole point. They're not paying for the animal. They're paying for the experience. When they go to someplace like Tanzania, the animal becomes a matter of indifference. Okay, that's not correct either. But I'm just saying, you know, it isn't like, you know, the first things too many guys can do is go up to an animal and go, where does this go in the book? You know, and they expect their professional hunter to tell them, oh, that'll be in the top 10%, you know, and they'll go, okay, great. And then I am at a loss for why that exists.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I can also realize that it does support game lands in South Africa that would otherwise have absolutely no economic value.
Yeah.
So it's
that's the part of it that starts to get really complicated.
It's a bargain with the devil. You know, it's do I want to go there and hunt? Probably not.
Because why?
I just don't have a good feeling afterward. It's
how many times have you hunted in Africa?
13 or 14 times over the last 40 years. No, I mean, there's guys, who've hunted lots.
This
lots,
guy has gone more.
Much, much more. The guy who wrote the introduction to my book, Craig Boddington,
yep,
has hunted 100 times.
Now, why in your whole book do you never mention someone shooting a hippopotamus?
They do. I would, that's kind of one of my dark secrets that I would love to do someday. But I don't want to shoot him in the water. I want to shoot him on the land.
The reason I asked that is I think that growing up in the United States, well, the other day I had a conversation with a friend of mine who just gone to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And we're talking about wildlife management in New Zealand.
Right.
Okay. Where generally the wildlife of general interest to hunters is all non-native, oftentimes deleterious, exotic wildlife.
Sure.
We're talking about like that world. And I was saying to him that growing up in the United States and understanding our systems in the United States leaves you completely ill-prepared to understand wildlife and wildlife management in a place like New Zealand.
Or Europe, or...
Yeah.
Yeah, almost the rest
anywhere
of, you know, most, world, other than...
It, there's an added North layer America to it in Africa, where I think that we don't know those animals. We only know the fictionalized version of the animals in mm-hmm. Africa. We don't know hippos. We know hippos as the way they've been presented to us in this elaborate fiction.
Fantasia. The dancing hippos in the
and this elaborate fantasia,
yeah,
of animation,
yeah,
of like kids, American kids learn what a zebra is before they learn what an elk is.
Yeah,
it's like animals. Those animals are somehow, some of those animals are so charismatic and
yeah,
so
yeah,
otherworldly that it winds up being that your average kid would be like giraffe, elephant, zebra, lion, and he would not be able to go jaguar, mountain lion,
yeah,
bobcat, elk, white, blacktail,
whitetail,
bighorn sheep.
It just is like
whitetail mule.
Like we live with these animals in a way that forms an impression of them as being somehow other than animals. So I think that a lot of the complication around Africa would be like a lot of people look. And I was reading your book, waiting for a hippo to come into it.
Because yeah,
when I look at a dude with a dead hippo, I just do not see a game animal. I don't know what I see, but I'm like, how in the world? Why? How?
Well, you know, I mean, that's...
Do you get that feeling?
Oh, sure.
Because I noticed you like sure, to hunt animals
giraffe,
there that seem... You hunt animals sure, that seem like... Yeah, you had a great sure, line. You talk about a giraffe, you jumped up, and it looked like a radio tower
yeah,
decided to run away.
And I've had people extol the virtues of... What a wonderful thing it was when they killed a giraffe.
But and you don't want to do it.
I have absolutely no interest.
Why don't you
in doing
want to shoot? Why in your book does no one really shoot at the animals that all little kids know about?
Well, I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, you know, giraffes and stuff. I mean, not giraffes, but zebras. Sure. I
like, you've hunted zebras?
Oh, yeah. I like zebras. Okay. You know, I mean, they're tough and they're smart.
And they seem, and you, and in your time in Africa, the zebra became like a game animal,
it
and
has
not
been,
like a thing from a child's mobile.
It's always been.
Over
it's all.
His crib.
It's always been a game animal.
Yeah.
You know. I mean.
No, but your perception of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I. You know. And there's the other aspect of it is one thing you begin to realize that you become something of a surrogate for the Africans you are hunting with.
Okay.
The people you are with, who are the trackers. You become the surrogate hunter for them because of the gross and fair unfairness, frankly, of the game laws, you know?
Oh, that you're able to hunt and they're not.
They can't afford it. They can't have firearms. They can't have, you know, they,
yeah. You had a line where you talked about poaching is a word for people doing what they used to do, but now it's illegal for them to do it.
Yeah. Well, kind of. I mean, it's you know.
It's like one day you went from a guy out getting food,
yeah,
and the next day you're a poacher.
Well, it's pretty much it. I mean, you know, the whole system of the colonial park system where they would take all these people and run them off of the. You read. I mean, I was talking about Ioannides. The
yep, I read that piece.
You know,
yeah,
and this guy created one of the monumental game reserves in human history.
In what country is that?
In Tanzania, in the Selu.
But he did it in a
21,000 square miles of wilderness. And he did it in the most bloodthirsty way imaginable. He didn't kill anybody, but he made sure that they had to leave.
The pastoralists.
Yeah, the pastoralists. And he got them out of there, you know. And now that is...
Yeah, you were mentioning that he had spent a big part of his career killing problem elephants.
Yeah.
But then once he got on this idea of establishing a wilderness...
Salute, yeah.
That when people would move in, they would provide no assistance to those people.
Right.
If a lion was getting them, if an elephant was getting them, it was like, tough shit, this is wilderness.
And he wanted to create literally a sanctuary for elephants where they were safe from poachers, you know, that they could basically, in that 21,000 square miles, they never had to go outside the boundaries of that area, and they were protected, you know? And it was part of the problem you get into, and it's always a tough one, is where on the scale does the value of the animal begin to outweigh the value of the human, you know?
Yeah.
Norm,
dude, that's a humongous question in this country.
Well, Norm Strung, who used to live here in Bozeman, he used to write for Field and Stream, and he would go down to Mexico every winter. He would like shut the house down, he and his wife, Sil, and they'd jump in the bass boat, and they'd go down to Lake Obregon or someplace down there. And they'd live there all winter fishing. And he said the first day he came back, he got to this village, and everybody comes out. They go, how'd you do? He goes, oh, man, we must have had 150 fish, you know, all largemouth bass. And they go, really, where are they? And they go, we threw them back. And he goes, you threw them back? You know, and he goes, and then he started looking around and he started seeing all these little kids with pellagra and you know, swollen bellies and stuff. And these, you know, this was a long time ago down in Mexico. But these villages were poor and they were protein hungry.
Yeah.
And he said, after that, to hell with it, I never threw anything back. I brought it in. And I gave it away. So, I mean, you kind of get into that bind when you're there. It's like,
because you mean literally human life. Because we could look and be like we have a conflict in this country with wilderness or wildlands, where we'd be like, I'm not asking you, like, this wilderness isn't going to mean you die. This is going to mean you might make a little less money than you otherwise might have made.
We have a tremendous luxury.
Yeah.
And we have just this unsurpassed gift, you know, that Africans would look at and they wouldn't understand you if you tried to explain to them, you know, why didn't you kill that lion? And they go, well, it's a beautiful animal. I didn't want to kill it. I just wanted to watch it, you know, go off into the sunset. And they go, that lion just killed two of my cows, you know? It chased my brother up a tree last week.
So you would never have a situation, because in your book, you get the sense, it's a weird part of of your trips, where you're out in what would be like, you're out in crazy shit. Lions running around, baboons, crazy animals, elephants, and then like dudes come rolling through camp.
Yeah.
And see if they could get like a chunk of meat.
Yeah.
And they got a cow with them.
Yeah.
So would you ever encounter people out in the wilderness who are like, man, it's not right that you're out here shooting our animals?
Well, I don't know if you ever read or you know who Joy Adamson was.
No.
She was the author who wrote Born Free.
Okay.
And she was she was actually an Austrian, I think. And she was married to George Adamson, who was one of the, you know, the kind of the bodhisattva of game rangers in Kenya. I mean, he was such an early proponent of concert. Anyway, I mean, he was a, you know, and she was
He was an early proponent of not shooting all the animals.
Well, he was
in
he,
order to have some to shoot.
Yeah, well, he was a proponent of like you know he was there on the ground working this stuff, you know. And then the whole story of Born Free is they found some lion. They found a lion.
I only know the song Born Free.
Yeah, well, they found a lion cub. Their mother was killed or something, or was dead, and then so they raised the lion cub, and it was called Elsa. And they raised Elsa the lion, and there was this, you know, then the song Born Free, and eventually she turned the lion back loose into the wild and let it go free again, and then it eventually started. Where the movie ended, they didn't mention the fact that the lion kept kind of hanging around, you know, people's camps and houses and villages, and somebody finally killed it.
Didn't get real wild.
Yeah, no, it never. It was habituated.
Yeah,
you know, it's like don't feed the bears.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I was in with Fletcher in Kenya. We were in Amboseli Park. We were changing blocks, and we stayed overnight in the lodge. And so we're in the restaurant, and I look up and I go, I see this blonde woman running around, you know, greeting and meeting everybody. And I go to Fletcher. I said, "Is that?" He goes, "Yeah, yeah. It's Joy Adamson." And I said, "Really?" Oh, he goes, "God sakes, don't tell her we're hunting."
And so then, even then and even there.
Well, even then, even there. And then, you know, and then she was eventually murdered by one of her servants because she was just not a nice lady.
Damn.
Well, you can be pretty mean and still not deserve to get murdered.
I didn't say she deserved it, but I'm just saying that she certainly didn't go out of her way to be nice.
You ever see the movie Bernie?
Bernie. No, what's that one?
Just explores, like, how bad do you got to be?
Right.
Before it's okay for someone to kill you.
Yeah, no, I'm not advocating.
No, I don't think you are.
No.
A thing I've noticed in recent years.
Yeah.
Let me interrupt that. You do a really good job of writing about giraffes running away.
Right.
The analogies.
Right.
Construction equipment taking off.
Yeah.
Or other things. Yeah. But the thing I think about when I think about Africa, especially through the lens of just why, like I'm interested in the controversies of hunting, right?
Sure.
Everybody is. And Africa, like the behavior of Americans in Africa generates this never ending amount of outrage.
Well, the behavior of Americans almost anywhere, you know.
Sure,
we have a chief executive who was saying to the first lady of France yesterday,
"She's good looking in good physical shape."
Yeah, you're in really great shape. So
that really surprised. That didn't surprise me, but it was like not reading the room real well.
No, it's no filter. No,
not
filter,
reading the room real
no
well.
Well, it's basically the I figured it out. It's the billionaire seduction technique. You know, like, "Hey, baby, I got $1 billion.
He told her, he turned to her and says, "You're in very good physical shape." And turns to the president in France and says, "Beautiful, very good physical shape." At which point she steps backwards. Dude, it was like, yeah, it was really surprising because I would go and meet the president of France.
Yeah.
And I would be thinking, I'll tell you one thing I'm not going to talk about is his wife.
Yeah. How is she over a muddy track?
So, the thing I've noticed about Africa is that African outrage, okay? So every day, like if you follow social media, every day there's a thing that everyone's supposed to be outraged over.
Yeah.
And we feign outrage and share our feigned outrage over social media. And one thing that people love to feign outrage over is someone having shot something in Africa that was cute or that was a fantastical animal that we feel is fantastical because of the way they're woven into the fabric of our culture, African megafauna. But it seemed to me that the thing that with Americans, they get more pissed the weirder it seems that the person that shot the thing would have been there shooting stuff. So if there's a guy that made millions doing like heating and cooling from Florida.
Dentists.
If he shoots something, generally it's different. If a young gal, a high school gal, say, were to go and shoot something in Africa, that is more offensive to Americans than if it was a guy from the heating and cooling industry.
Yeah.
except for Cecil the Lion, the dentist guy.
Yeah.
Now, if that had been a high school cheerleader, that would have been like really bad.
Yeah.
But it was as bad as could be. Now, as a guy who's been going there 40 years, what's your take on all that?
Well,
like, who's to blame for how ridiculous that all seemed?
Well, the first thing is don't post your pictures on social media. As if
that's a message.
If I can give you, if I am going to be your campaign advisor,
okay.
do not post the pictures on social media.
But that's why people do stuff.
And that is exactly the problem.
That's why people get out of bed.
That's exactly the problem. I mean, you know, it's. I remember talking to a PH one time, and he was telling me about this guy had taken this just incredible looking animal. I mean, I think it was a Nile Leschwe.
I don't know what the hell that is.
Yeah, right.
That was not my mobile as a child.
No. But it was a beautiful Nile. It's one of those kind of things that you could just, even if you'd never seen a Nile Leschwe before, if you saw this one, you would go, that is the Nile Leschwe of Nile Leschwes.
I guess this
can
is
you kind of sort it's of not describe
a
bird. It?
Is it a monkey?
No.
Okay.
It's an antelope. It's an antelope.
Oh, Michelle's pulling up a picture. Oh, yeah, it's a good looking critter.
Or Mrs. Gray's Leschwe.
Oh, yeah.
They're black and white with that big S-shaped horns.
Yeah, that's anyway. A bad mofo right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Okay, so there
that
you
looks
go.
Like a game animal to me.
Yeah, and they're good eating, you know, and that's the other aspect. But you know, he had this guy who would hunt with him, and he was showing me this picture. Oh, that's great looking. He goes, what did he put in the book? And he goes, no, he doesn't have he has nothing. And he said, this guy has killed so many hunted. I would rather say, this guy has hunted more trophy book animals in Africa than almost anybody I know. He's never put a single one in the book because he doesn't want to. He doesn't care.
About the recognition.
Yeah, that's not why he's doing it.
I like that guy.
Well, yeah. I mean,
you're aware that I'm a turkey grand slam holder.
Well, so am I. I'm a super slam holder.
So is it annoying that I'm asking about the lion? Cecil the lion?
No.
What's your take on it?
You know,
I don't know.
I mean, I am guilty.
Can I ask it in two parts?
Sure.
Part A.
Yeah.
What's your take on what happened? Not how it was perceived.
No, I know.
Was that business as usual, or was that like a fucked up thing that happened?
I have serious reservations about the affair. The Macomber affair. This was the Cecil affair.
Okay, please lay it on.
Yeah.
Me.
No, I mean.
This is part A, mind you. Part B is going to be what's your take on how it was perceived.
It's a park lion that they sat on the edge of the park and waited for it to walk out.
You feel that they knew?
Of course they knew. Of course. And the other thing about it was because it's people make a big deal like this guy spent $50,000. That's cheap. That's cheap.
But that's okay.
I mean, no.
That's a part that shouldn't matter. Is it better if it was free?
That lion should have cost $75,000 to $100,000 because that's what the market is. If you're going to go, you know, the invisible hand of capitalism, he got that lion for about half price.
Okay.
And the reason he got it for half price was the guy. I have to be careful here because I'm not sure, you know, if we want to get into like areas that maybe.
Oh, I don't understand what you're saying right now.
Well, I'm just saying we don't want to get into the areas where because I may suggest that there was some illegal activity involved.
I got you,
but I'm not saying it was that hunter.
But you don't know that was yeah.
I'm with I don't
you.
Know that was the case.
I appreciate.
But what I suspect.
Okay.
And this is purely suspicion, and has absolutely no basis in fact. And as far as I know, the guy who killed it's good to his mother and everything else.
Loves his mother.
And the guy he hunted with, the professional hunter, was also loves his mother. And the African guy whose property they shot it on, which abuts the park, he is the salt of the earth.
That was private property.
Yeah. So
that was a dude's land?
Yeah, I believe. Huh. Well, it's up. Now you have me there, because I'm not really sure. There was some question about who had the permit and
It's kind of immaterial, so I don't want to bog us down.
You're getting into the weeds on this one.
Yep.
But the reason I think, in my own opinion, and without knowing if this guy did anything wrong, is that if that lion was what appears to me to be rather cheap, it was because they knew where that lion was, and they didn't have to spend a lot of time hunting it.
Gotcha.
You know? That if they had to go, if you had to go to Tanzania tomorrow and hunt and you got to remember, in Tanzania, you have to, your lion, the lion has to be, you have to age the lion on the hoof, as it were, so you know it's 6 years old or older. You can't take anything younger than that anymore in Tanzania.
Okay.
By law, you know? And if you actually went to Tanzania looking for a lion like that and in the wild and everything else like that, you could be there hunting a month. You know, you could be there and you could spend $75,000 to $100,000. So
because what?
Because of the rarity of it.
It's a hard hunt.
It's a hard hunt. You know, it's like shooting a 400-point bull elk in the mountains.
Yeah.
If it was easy.
You got a month? Because it might take 10 years of a month.
You know, I mean it's yeah. And from what I understand of this situation was they didn't hunt him that long.
Okay.
And then a crossbow? He shot it with a crossbow. I got nothing against crossbows, but
you feel it might have been a noise factor.
I don't know. No, I won't go that far. I think it was part of the you know, the esprit of the whole thing.
I got you.
I'm going to add my own little twist to this by hunting him with a crossbow.
Okay.
I don't know. But I don't know that. I don't know any of
Can
it.
I add two things here? Because I'd like to get your impression on this.
Yeah.
I think about this almost, I think about this bi-weekly at least. Now, why, moving into the perception of it.
Yeah.
Why do Americans get mad when they hear that someone paid a lot for something? And it's puzzling to me for this reason. If we look at the history of colonialism, it generally is that you go into a country and you take valuable shit and don't pay anyone for it.
Right.
And take it back home.
Right.
So here's a system where a feller, even though, as you're pointing out, may have underpaid, he goes in and he pays an outrageous sum for a thing that he would like to remove from the land. And that is more offensive to Americans than had he just gone and stolen it.
Well,
I would think that people would be like, well, at least the son of a bitch gave him $50,000. But people get pissed about the money. They're like, he paid $250,000 to kill a rhino. That's asshole-ish. A better guy wouldn't have paid shit.
Maybe. I mean,
but that's kind of what you're saying.
Well, no, that's, I listen.
Why is that upsetting?
Well, you know, why do we get pissed off when we see people, you know, with you know, Rolls Royces and bling?
Because you're jealous. Because you...
I wish I'd been born rich instead of good looking, you know? I mean, I had a friend of mine who always would complain about the fact he was from Mississippi, and he had, you know, he kind of like worked his way up into the upper echelons of, but there was a point in his life where he said, you know, if I had as much money as that son of a bitch over there, I'd make him look like Ned's First Primer.
I don't understand what that means.
Oh, Ned's First Primer. That's the book you used to read in the little schoolhouse that taught you ABCs.
And it was a good looking guy or not?
No. That's not the whole point.
I don't understand the point.
Okay. Back up. His point was that, he was jealous of all these other guys who had so much money they could hunt anything they wanted to in the world.
Okay.
You know?
Oh.
And his argument was, if I had that kind of money, I would make them look like Ned's First Primer, which means that
he'd drown them in dead shit.
He would make them look like amateurs from the word go.
Can I ask my second question?
Yes.
This didn't occur to me till the other day. Yesterday, a guy, an outdoor photographer named John Hafner, who shoots a lot of wildlife photography, showed me a picture of a lion, a male lion.
Yeah.
And he's got a big ass mane. John says that lion is actually a collared lion. Where's a radio collar? You can't see the damn collar.
Yeah.
He's got a thick ass mane.
Yeah.
So with the Cecil, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about Cecil. Unless you got more you want to add.
No, but go ahead. Yeah.
A big part of the story, people were pissed.
Oh, yeah.
That he paid for it, and people were also pissed that it had a collar. But I don't know that that would have been known. Do you think that that would have been known or not known?
Well, yeah, they had to cut it off.
Because right now, am I circumcised or not circumcised?
Prior.
You don't know?
Well, they I mean, it was like I was listening to the radio coming up here, and they're talking about some guy in Kentucky who was on the run because he cut off his ankle bracelet, you know, yesterday.
Oh, yeah, they cut it off after. But is it?
I mean, it's
you
it,
feel
it
that
shows,
they knew before they shot it. Not that that would have mattered.
That lion was, it was Cecil, for God's sake.
Yeah, but people told, I also read a lot about this, that like that name didn't quite have the cachet
in
life that it did in death.
No, I understand. No, that's correct. But there's a lot, in my mind at least, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that this lion's fate had been sealed before the hunter ever got to Africa. That
like a guy's like, you know what? A fella could probably lure that island, you know, that lion out of there.
There was a phone call to somebody at some point and said, I've got this lion over here. I'm pretty sure if we, you know, we put a dead eland or something, and this is not what I'm saying happened, but I'm just saying that we can get this, we can pull this lion out of the park, you know? Yeah. And that's going to be the same thing when, you know, if we get to where we can hunt grizzlies down south of here, wherever we hunt them again.
Yeah, man.
There's going to be. Where do you draw the line? I don't know. I mean,
well, I'll tell you where I would draw it. At the park boundary.
Maybe.
That's probably not where it's going to be drawn.
No, but I mean, but you know, what difference does it make if you keep pushing it out and there's going to be a line somewhere, you know? And I don't know, that leaves me. You know, I don't think I'm going to be shooting a grizzly, so that's fine. You know?
I don't intend to put in for a tag.
No, I don't either. You know, but I can see where it would be really interesting for some people, and it could be done, and it can be done right.
Yeah.
You know, but eventually it's going to come down to lines. You know, there's a line here. What do you know? So I don't know. Yeah.
When that was playing out, this is honestly the last question.
Sure.
When that was playing out. Let me preface it by this. A friend of mine did many tours in Iraq and Afghanistan in the Navy. Okay. Now he comes home, gets out of the military, and every time something is in the news about Iraq or Afghanistan, I would go to him being like, hey, what's your take on? And he said, now at this point, I read the newspaper like anybody else. I don't have, like, my time there doesn't give me the feeling of having, like, insight. It doesn't give me the feeling of, like, that I'm following that story more carefully. Okay? So if you're a guy who's written hundreds of pages about hunting in Africa, when a story like that happens and everyone fires up the outrage machine, do you see it as just a guy like, huh? Or do you see it as, this is my realm, my world, my professional space. I must interject and give clarity to all the people who are out looking now. Or is it just like, I don't know. The guy shot a lion. I don't know.
I don't know that I feel that I can offer an opinion in that sense.
Okay.
You know, I know how I feel about these things. I mean, I hate to say it, but hunting is, you know, what's the line about, quote Hemingway, I guess it is, it's what we have instead of God, you know?
Yeah.
And I, you know, for me, there's something of hunting is, in a way, at least one of my religions, if I want to consider myself polytheistic.
I'm following you.
You know? And the older I get, the more I get into it, the less I hate seeing piss in the cathedral.
That's how I feel. That's, you know, a good way of putting it. I'm glad you just said that.
You know? I mean, don't go piss in the baptismal fountain. You know?
That's
it. But I don't know how you teach that. I don't know how you instruct that. I don't know that how you. I mean, I don't know. And I don't want to be one of these crabs who just, you know, oh, you horrible human being. What are you, you know? I don't. You know, if you can sleep at night, that's fine. And you know, and if you're if there are scientifically based, well enforced laws that make sense, then go for it. You know, I don't know that. I mean, I'm not sure where ethics. There are ethics, and that's we do have an ethical structure that we believe in. You know, just because something is legal doesn't mean it's right.
Sure.
You know, or moral or ethical.
But that was the Aldo Leopold.
Yeah.
Everybody likes the part of the quote where he says, like, ethics is what you do when no one's watching.
Right.
But he goes on to say, even when it's legal.
Yeah. You know, and that's, but that is, you know, when it's, what the as a society, we can only enforce the law.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we can try to shape ethics, but that is more of a cultural definition we're putting on things.
Ethics and law walk through life hand in hand in many ways.
Maybe, you know, I mean, I think there's, you know, it's, yeah, but I don't know. I don't know who's the handmaiden and who is the not. You know.
No, I understand.
I'm not sure.
You know who I think? I think that ethics is the mother holding the hand, the child's hand of law.
Yeah, except
I'll have to think about that more to
Except the law in this case is
a derelict.
Is no, he's like 7'3" and weighs 400 pounds and has a big mallet. You know, we can talk about what the law is capable of doing to people's lives. If which ethics are not, you know, ethics. I mean, ethics shouldn't be able to take away your liberty or your freedom. Laws can take away your liberty and your freedom. You know,
yeah.
Ethics can shame you. Law can execute you.
But that, you know, that's a funny thing, because I find that when hunters get in trouble.
Yeah.
When hunters get in trouble, they like to, especially in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Hunters get in trouble and they like to go, but it was legal. And they're kind of like, people are thinking about one thing and they're talking about another thing. Mm-hmm. Because they don't do like, I have a wife and kids, okay? So let's say it emerged that at night, I would sneak out and just go have sex with women in bars that I met in bars.
Right.
Later, someone's like, dude, did you hear? Can you believe his wife at home taking care of those kids and he's out? Like, is there room for me to go? But it's legal.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
No one doubted the legal. No one cares that it was legal.
And
no one's like, oh, ha, yeah, my bad, cool.
But that again, I mean, there isn't any way of that I know of, you know, of persuading a sociopath or a narcissist, because what you're talking about is narcissism, and you know, sociopathology. It's not criminal. But it sure makes life hell for everybody around you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know, I mean, it's like you know, if a guy's cheating on his wife, he's making it hell for her. He's not breaking the law, though.
Yeah,
that's where community comes in, and social and culture.
Well, you know, but even you would think that it would be something internalized in the human being that it would come to him. At some point, and going, you know, I am a dog. I am a two-dick dog who should be shot.
Well, if we're taking it back to the example of hunting,
yeah,
I see like that can be like hyper like local, and like it's across the country. Imagine like there's different social norms in like Alabama than there are in Idaho, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it comes back to ethics and your community almost holding you accountable.
Yeah.
And I'm a big proponent of that. And I love thinking about the ethics of hunting because it's so interchangeable.
What are the ethics of hunting raccoons with hounds in California versus the ethics of hunting raccoons with hounds in Tennessee? You know?
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. All right. You know, I blew this because earlier I mentioned this quote I can't remember who it's true. No, yeah, the Hemingway quote where someone's like, where he says, you know, oh, we should go hunt in Africa. And he's like, I got no desire. And he says, just because you haven't read a book about it.
Right.
Reading the book, I've decided I'm real interested in, I've adopted your favorite animal as my favorite animal to hunt. Can you talk about like Cape Buffalo?
Yeah.
How it is that in your mind is like that in your mind is like the animal. And earlier you were gonna, I think you started to say something and got distracted.
No.
You're gonna say that when you hunt, you're a surrogate,
right,
for the people you're with. And I thought that at that point you were gonna point out that you get excitement from what excites them.
Well, yeah, that's exact. Well, okay, that's.
So talk about Cape Buffalo, weave that in.
I mean, you can get a sense where, you know, certain animals, you know, if you take an impala, if you hunt an impala, and you make a, you know, reputable good shot, it's clean kill, and they have meat for camp, you know, they're going to come up and they're going to go, congratulations. The difference between that and if you have to. If you bring down a buffalo with one shot, the effusiveness of their response is going to be, for one thing, they're not going to have to follow a wounded buffalo into the bush, you know, which they do not want to do, which nobody in his right mind wants to do. There are some people in their wrong minds who do, but so yeah, no, there is that. I mean, you know, they. I can look at an animal. Africans never get bored hunting a buffalo. They never get blasé about hunting a buffalo.
Because of the risk.
Because of lots of reasons. You know, they have this sort of ultimate respect for a buffalo. You know, it becomes very difficult to, you know, what is it? I'm not sure. You know, it's like it's like pornography. I know it when I see it. You know,
who was it that said that?
Justice Potter Stewart. There is something about, you know, when you're hunting a buffalo, that this is an animal and you have the advantage.
What do they weigh?
About 1500 pounds, 1600 pounds, you know, and they can run 30 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour, pretty good clip. The other part of it is I've gotten older and, you know, I think more in terms of the fact that there's so much meat.
That's why people get excited about them too.
That's part of it. You know, there is the reward of hunting buffalo well is in and of itself hunting buffalo well. That you know, you didn't mess it up. You didn't cause a scene. You didn't cause a traffic accident in the middle of wherever you were.
Yeah.
You know? And then when
wounding one and
nothing and everything goes to worse comes to worse and it just gets worse. But
have you know, experienced that?
Yeah. Sure. You know? And never had anything where it was I was ever really threatened, but I, you know, spent a lot of time trailing a wounded animal that I really didn't feel very good about having caused.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the things you say you like so much about it is that you have to follow them into the thick shit.
Yeah.
And it's like a very, you're not choosing to have it be close. It just has to wind up being close.
Yeah. I mean, you basically want to be as close as you can get. You know, there's the old saying, the old adage, you get absolutely as close as you can and get 100 yards closer. Yeah. And, you know, and you could be, you know, when you don't want to be.
That's an adage for hunting Cape Buffalo.
Yeah. Any dangerous game.
Well, I remember there's a point there where you had someone at 200 yards. You're like,
No. Yeah, no, that's not. That's not. That's shooting and not hunting. if you know what I mean. I mean, you can kill a buffalo at 200 yards. You can kill a buffalo at 300 yards. You know, and why?
But what makes it then hunting at 100 that it's not at 200? It's just
Well, it's like anything else. You're giving him, you know, you're not throwing away your advantage, but you're giving him more play for his senses. You're giving him more of a chance of what do the English call it, twigging to you, you know, discovering that you're there, smelling you.
So you're not trailing them into the brush because that's how you got to find them. You're doing it because it's an act of respect to the animal.
No, you're going in. I mean, that's where they are. That's their turf. You know, that's their beach, their wave. That's where they live. You know, the you can find herds out in the middle of big open plains.
Passing through.
But you know, you'll at some point you'll end up having to go into the trees and look for them.
And that's unnerving.
You know, it starts out that way, and then I mean, this sounds.
Then you use that up.
You use that up, and then it becomes like, I want to do this again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I first started hunting buffalo, they scared the crap out of me. You know, because we couldn't see them; they were just in this. You know, you're just crawling in after them. And then they would, all of a sudden you'd hear this, like just this massive explosion of animals. And you'd hear they got those big bosses on their horns, that big horn cap. And you'd hear them smacking into the trees and coming through there, you know, and which way are they going? You know, are they coming at me? Are they going away? And,
You mentioned
what would cause that explosion.
Well, just they're just going. Yeah, they drop their heads and they're going.
But I mean, just out of the blue, they're feeding one minute and going to the next. Well,
they've caught your wind.
Okay.
Or they've heard you snap a twig, and you know you've got like 20 or 30 of them all together. So you got 20 or 30 sets of eyes, and 20 or 30 sets of ears, and 20 or 30 sets of noses. So it's like, you know, you ever notice like on whitetail and turkeys are always together.
Yeah,
and I figured that out was because turkeys can't smell and whitetail can't see as well as turkeys can, but they know how to trigger off of each other.
Yeah,
anyway,
I'm with you.
Leave that there
because you talk about that bird all the time that lifts up.
Yeah, yeah, the tick bird.
You see that tick bird, you know that there's some.
Yeah,
and you also talk about that you could creep in there and get 30 yards away, and there's a 1,500 pound animal on its feet looking at you, and you might not catch it.
Yeah.
You might not detect its presence.
The guy I was telling you about, the old guy who taught me who I inherited my love of Africa from, I guess. But I mean, he the first elephant he ever took was in French Equatorial Africa in 1956 or something. And he and the tracker, because the professional hunter had gotten sick, got malaria. So they just went with the tracker, just he and the tracker, and they were hunting elephants. And he said he'd never seen an elephant in the wild at all. And they were crawling in through the forest. I mean, crawling, hands and knees. And the tracker, like, you know, grabbed him and he said, there, you know, there. And he's looking and looking and looking. He can't see anything. And he's looking back and forth, and the guys keeps pointing. And suddenly he sees 30 feet in front of him, four legs, you know? And they look like big tree trunks. And then he keeps looking up and up and up. And there's this head, you know, kind of like, just in there, you know, pulling stuff off the branches. And he said that was his first elephant he'd ever seen anywhere in the wild. But that's kind of what happens with buffalo. You get in there, you know.
Can't find them.
Like any untrained game eye.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing about, that's, like I say, these trackers are, you know, like there. And you're going like, where? You know, and they go, there. And they just, you know, they just know where it is. That's inborn. That's innate. I don't know. It's a wonderful mystery.
How do you, I want to ask how you cope with something or how you perceive something when you hunt there a lot. This could be true for anyone who does like a lot of guided hunting. Okay. Yeah. Where, Like I look at hunting as being a thing where you sort of acquire, like it's this never ending thing of like acquiring skills.
Yeah.
Okay. developing a skill set.
Yeah.
And no one knows the end of it. Right?
Right.
There's no cap. There's no arrival moment.
Right.
Right. In fact, the more you climb,
there's no ceiling.
The more you become aware of the lack of a ceiling.
There's no ceiling. Yeah.
I think early on you could feel that it was there, but it's not there. And I find that if you're not brought up doing it, it creates a separate, it creates a cap too. Like it's hard to come in late and climb very high.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in Africa, I feel that unachievable ceiling probably doesn't really seem to be there because you have so much infrastructure around you that's invested in you getting it. And it would almost be that if you were a hunter, you would feel like, I'm not bringing anything to this. In
right.
fact, I'm slowing this whole thing down.
Like you are the impediment.
They yeah. would get this done faster and more efficiently were it not for my presence.
Hand them the gun. Let them
So go. How do you cope with that?
Well, you know, it's an imperfect world. You know, I mean, if in a different time, in a different age, you were born in Africa. You know, a lot of these professional hunters were born growing up in the bush, you know, and they hunted for their families and for themselves. So they learned it that way. I guess I could look at it in that regard and say, well, I'm not bringing everything to the game. I am. But does that mean I don't want to do something that I have come to love?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's the, you know, I mean, you know, the satisfaction of like hunting something on your own and, you know, I go in there, you pack
it up. I know both satisfactions. I know that satisfaction and I know the satisfaction of making a friend who does something really well. And then your friend takes you out and lets you be along with him.
Yeah.
And the thrill of learning.
Well, I think
thrill of learning.
That's, you know, if you can get to that stage with Africans, and that to me is, I don't know a better way of doing that. I've never found a better way. Maybe there is one that I don't know about.
Yeah.
Or at least that I've experienced. I mean, when you get to the point where when you have done something that a bunch of African hunters, trackers, look at you and go, you know, give you a thumbs up. It's you know, it's golden.
Yeah.
Because you know when it's genuine.
Listen, I don't want you to think that I'm saying that I don't.
No.
I do go into those situations.
No, but I'm just saying, it's, and you know the difference when it's genuine and when it's perfunctory or pro forma. You know, I'm the tracker. I'm supposed to tell this guy, you know, good job, Buona.
Yeah.
But when they sincerely do it and honestly do it, you know you've earned that from them. That's it's a great sensation. It's a great feeling.
Yeah.
And I think
for sure. I think some people would think that needing that not, I don't want to say needing. I think that some people would think that basking in that approval is childish, but I do not, because I do like that.
Well,
there are ways to calibrate one's performance and to do things and be in a atmosphere of other people. And to get to a point where other people are like, job well done.
You know? Yeah, no, I mean it's when you can move 1/10 as quietly as an African and stay up with them, you know, going through the bush, that comes back to you. You get there's a feedback loop in that where you get that energy and you feed on it.
Did you feel like over the years that did you feel like you learned a lot?
Yeah.
Or just, was it like mostly having experiences, or was it learning too?
It's always learning. I mean, I always have learned. I've tried to learn no matter where I was, you know. I want to talk to the people. I want to know what they're doing. I want to know, you know, whatever. I don't know I don't think it's in the book, but I was just writing something the other day about, you know, going to places, how you go why would I hunt in Africa instead of going on a photo safari?
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with going on a photo safari. It's just, but I suddenly realized that the people I am dealing with in a photo lodge situation, these are people who are in the service industry. Now, you could argue that trackers are not in the service and are also in the service industry.
Yeah, but that's not a very good argument.
But I'm just saying, you know, that there is that it's a different relationship from where I am, you know, when a guy's hovering around me wanting to know if he can pour me some more wine and get a bigger tip. Yeah. You know? And whereas if I'm dealing with a tracker, you know, where he'll stop and he'll point to the tracker and we'll try to figure it out, you know. What are we looking for here? You know? And it's all there is a language barrier that just disappears.
Yeah.
That doesn't, you know, and he doesn't speak English, I don't speak Swana or Kikuyu or something else, but we communicate. We understand each other. And that's like just, yeah. I mean, just, I don't know. I'm starting to get, you know, it's hard not to get nostalgic about it.
What about that nostalgia? Because I get a sense, like, even the name, I feel like the name of your book, like, Having the Autumns,
yeah.
Right? There's August in Africa,
yeah.
There's an endiness. Do you like is it done? I could rattle off some stuff.
No, I mean it's like I'm going back in January.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I'm gonna go to Burkina Faso. And the reason I'm going to Burkina Faso is there's a relatively small area, like 250,000 hectares or something. That's really wild country. There's elephants and lions there walking around. There's no fences. And there's a different buffalo. There's the savannah buffalo. So I want to go back. I want to hunt two animals. That's it. I want to hunt the savannah buffalo and the western roan. And the western roan is like, I mean, it's kind of like a really mean whitetail. it's a disgruntled whitetail because they're very smart and they love to, and they're just beautiful animals. Wonderful eating. You know, people don't really pay much attention to it, but the game meat's great.
Does anything in Africa have antlers?
Actually giraffes are pedicels, which are not, they're kind of proto, antlers. And there are red deer in northern Africa.
Is that right?
Yeah, the Barbary red deer is
native.
Native.
You know what surprised me? You talk about hunting Sus scrofa.
Yep.
You talk about hunting wild pigs in Africa.
Yeah.
I didn't know in northern Africa they have straight up wild hogs.
Yeah.
Sounds like a shitload of them.
Yeah. Lots. In Tunisia. Yeah. They're all over the place.
But I point out to people about like autumns in Africa, like
August in Africa.
Oh, sorry, not autumns. Oh, I said autumns earlier. August.
August in Africa.
But you go a lot of other months.
Yeah, but it's a figurative time. You know, in fact, the first time I went to Africa, it was September, but there's an August feel to it.
Yeah,
you know, it's especially growing up in like Southern California. You know, you get that kind of late August weather and the climate, and that's kind of what you run into in Africa when you're there. Sometimes, you know, it can feel like that, and it's more a metaphorical time than it is an actual calendar date.
Yeah.
Conjures a bit of romance and nostalgia, like you said.
Well, there's a quote on the cover from Robert Rourke, which is, you know, that's when they burn the grass in July and the decent hunting starts in August.
Mm.
Which in the one little part of Africa he hunted, you know. That's something about Hemingway too. I mean, Hemingway never got out of East Africa, and Rourke never got out of East Africa, pretty much.
Never got out of.
No.
So how much have like, okay, take it for granted that there's this gradual decline, like there's a gradual decline of wild places in the world. That's just like a way to explain world history, okay? The peopling of the world. So taken outside of just that general gradual thing that happens,
right?
How much are the good old days here or not here? Because I oftentimes find myself, when I'm talking about hunting in America, I try to remind people that depending on how wide your net is, that there's a pretty good argument to be made that we're in the good old days right now.
Well, sure. Yeah. And you have a different, you know, again, we have the luxury or the benefit of, you know, the greatest conservation system, wild conservation system in the world. You know, if you look at other places, you're talking about New Zealand and Europe and you know, South Africa, we're you know, this is animal husbandry that's going on in those places.
South Africa, New Zealand.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's animal husbandry.
Yeah.
On a with wild animals. Whereas we actually still have, you know, truly wild populations. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's more game here than there was, and that's a loaded word as well, game. You know, I mean, that's, people probably give you a hard time about that word.
Yeah, I don't care about those people.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me what you really think. Anyway, but they, I don't know what you can say about Africa, except that it does continue to decline. And that's, I don't know what the solution is.
You don't feel that it's a factor of hunting?
No.
It's a factor of...
It's factors...
Like wildlife is inconvenient.
Yeah. Inconvenient. And
tastes good.
And let's put it this way. That you could ban all hunting in Africa tonight. Absolutely ban it all. Legal, licensed hunting. And the populations would probably decline even faster.
Just because it would de-incentivize.
Yeah, there'd be no reason to keep anything around. And it's hard to...
Because no one's making money off its existence.
And it's you're asking Africans to support wildlife when they can't, in many cases, support themselves. You know? We think you should let these elephants run through your whatever. And they're going to go, why?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I mean, if you woke up in the morning and there was a bison smashing your Subaru to shreds, you know, you would probably go, oh, shoot him. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody goes, no, you can't do that. Don't do that. You can't do that. Well, okay.
You'd be like, then someone's going to have to give me a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, but nobody's going to give you any money in Africa. You know, if you come back and, you know, someone's destroyed, you know, the elephants have destroyed your crops trying to get them. I think one of the big things that's making a difference. I mean, the Maasai are using, they can use cell phones and they can call each other and they, you know, they can go, elephants are in the maze tonight, you know, and they'll run in there and try to chase them out. But that, so maybe that's an advantage. But of course, the cell phone also helps the poachers. So, yeah. You know.
Why is it now, why does it cost $250,000 to kill a rhino?
Why does it cost $250,000 to get a governor's permit for a, you know,
small,
for a sheep?
Small pool.
Yeah. You know, that there is.
And what are the ones that do get killed?
The ones that do get.
Like, what are the situations where they're, like, how many rhinos are hunted every year? Like, a handful.
Are they culled? Like, are they identified?
Yeah, that's what
is
I mean.
Is that what
are
you
they,
mean?
Yeah.
Well, there's, you know, there's two kinds. There's white rhino and the black rhino.
Okay.
Now, the white rhino is actually the more popular, it is now, it didn't used to be, but is now the more populous species.
Did not used to be.
Oh, no, they were almost gone.
Okay.
You know, the and there's a long history of that, but if you you can go back to the South Africans back in the 50s or 60s. They wanted to kill them all off because they wanted more land for grazing and cattle.
Okay.
And there was like, there was one little herd of white rhino on this park, 300 animals maybe, and they were getting all inbred, and it was just total disaster. And then a guy named Ian Player, who was the golfer, Gary Player's brother, came in and just started capturing these things and spreading them out, you know, spreading them to different areas. And in that amount of time, they went from like 300 to there's, I don't know, 25,000 or something now.
Okay.
In South Africa.
So what's up with black rhinos?
Well, black rhino were the opposite. They were like, when the white rhino was down to like 300, there was probably 100,000 black rhino. Unfortunately, black rhino have horns, and the horn is mistakenly thought of as an aphrodisiac or a medicinal. It is a popular ingredient in Asian medicine.
Because here's this animal with a big phallus growing out of his forehead.
Well, kind of, it's matted hair, but it's also the same. The other part of it is also is Yemeni sheiks wanted the horn for their, you know, their decorative dagger handles because it's, you know, it's this beautiful material when it's worked, and they would, so here's the thing. If you want to shoot a black rhino to poach it.
Hold on one sec. Is that what it, like, is it the mechanical removal of black rhinos, killing them for their horns?
Yeah.
Not habitat loss.
Well, there's probably so few, there's a lot of habitat. There's a lot of parks.
That could have rhinos on it.
Could have rhinos on it, but they get killed pretty fast.
Okay.
And it's a running firefight.
Did you see someone went into a French zoo and shot a rhino?
No, but I shot
a rhino and stole the horn.
Yeah. Well, people in
a damn zoo.
Oh my gosh.
People in Africa who had mounted rhino heads in their, have come home and their house has been broken into, and someone's
gone,
chopped off the horn off of it. Because, well, from a pragmatic standpoint, okay, so I want to get a permit to hunt a black rhino.
Okay.
Now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says, if you can prove to me that, you can prove to us that by hunting this rhino, you're actually, which is an endangered species, if you can prove to us that by hunting this, you're actually going to improve the species, improve the survival for the species by pumping a lot of money into conservation, then have at it. So the governments in like Namibia and places like that have viable populations of black rhino, and also part of the problem is they want to get rid of the old bulls because they are a drug on the market, as they say. They don't breed, they've done breeding. They take over territory and they want to move them out. That if you kill one, you're going to actually end up with net more rhinos because you're pulling this one out of the, out of the herd. So a guy comes over to Namibia. He pays the Namibian government $250,000, $350,000. That money then ostensibly is earmarked for various conservation projects related to the black rhino. He then can import, which is important to him, he can import that rhino head into the United States.
Okay.
Now, the alternative is a poacher comes out in the middle of the night, jacklights it, shoots it, sells the horn for $20,000.
It's worth $20,000.
Yeah. It was. And these things are going up and down.
Yeah, I'm with you.
The big deal right now is like if you can believe that China is actually going to stop the trade, and they said they finally got around to saying, yeah, we're no more ivory, no more, we're done. And if they do that, it's going to dry everything up, and there's going to be no incentive to start poaching these things
anymore. So it might help.
Well, it can't hurt, you know.
Well.
Yanni? Dude, your book really made me think about a ton of shit I hadn't thought about before.
Well, could I read a small piece out of it?
Please.
Okay.
What's interesting to me is that not a single topic of the last hour and a half has been without controversy of something.
No, but that was my approach to the book. I didn't approach the book just wanting to hear cool hunting stories. I approached the book because I'm like a guy who is like just I have an inner struggle. Like, do I want to go? Is it a thing that in my life needs to happen as a person who's pursuing hunting as a discipline and as a mechanism for exploration? Mm-hmm. Like, is that or is that not? I came out of that book thinking that I would like to go to a wilderness type area and travel with people who grew up in that environment and travel with them and crawl through that thick ass brush looking for a Cape Buffalo.
Or the, you know, the other possible, I mean, if you really want to get, there's the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Brazzaville. Yeah. And there you hunt the forest dwarf. And don't be mistaken by the fact they're called dwarf forest buffalo, because they're actually more dangerous than the Cape buffalo because of the habitat they live in. And that is where you actually, that is, I haven't done it, but that is way wicked. I mean, that is, you are hunting, a lot of the times you're hunting with pygmies. And you know, and you can imagine what that must be, like the trip that must be, going into these.
Yeah, we've talked with our buddy about doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I don't mean, do you feel, you know, it's like, yeah, customer satisfaction surveys. Do you feel that in our conversation that I've focused on shit that you wish I hadn't focused on?
No. No, I mean, I appreciate, you know.
Like 1 to 10, how likely would you be?
to what? Yeah.
To
recommend this to a friend. Well, I don't want to. I mean, you know, you haven't put this on the air yet, so it depends how politic I want to be. The point being that this has been a refreshingly intelligent conversation for me.
Okay.
Because, you know, you're not an African hand. Let's put it that way.
What's that mean?
Well, you don't have any on the ground experience in Africa.
No,
right?
None.
That's a fair assumption. But you're a hunter.
Yep.
And you can understand the motivations of why people would go some
100%
crazy ass place like Africa, and why once they went there, they kept going back when they really had no business financially or economically, or you know, trying to put a kid through college and a wife, you know, to keep her fed at least once a week. You know, she's already going like, you're not going back, are you? And I'm going like, no, I might. I go, God, no. So, yeah, I mean, I give it a solid 9.5. How's that?
Okay.
I
wasn't even worried about it until Giannis just said that.
No, I wasn't saying that.
He always struck me as a troublemaker.
Well, we're not going to sit down and swap old hunting stories about Africa because I haven't gone there, Giannis.
No. But I just think that's sort of
there is no way in this day and age that you cannot talk about Africa without creating controversy.
And I think even with two completely like-minded people, two hardcore African hunters, they'd probably find some controversy.
You know, and
it's to Africa. It just seems like it's inherent almost.
I mean, there's. Let's put it this way. Hunting in Africa gives you the potential of being the worst person you ever were in your entire life, or maybe not the best person, but a pretty damn good person.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
There's that. There's that choice. There is that, you know, there is that option available.
Yeah. You talk about some time you spent on a trip with a person who embarrassed you a great deal.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. He was,
their views on the culture, their views on racial issues.
Yeah. He was a piece of work.
Yeah.
I mean, I was
really, that's a good story. Cause you really go to just have such a visceral hatred for that guy,
you know? And it was mutual.
But yeah. It came to a point where the author, Tom here, said, why did you come to Africa?
except to shoot stuff. You know? And it's like, when I was 20, I could understand that because, you know, you're 20. You want to, you have that, you know, you want to hunt everything.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, you know, I'm happy to go back and like, I mean, I envy somebody like Craig Boddington because he's like over in Liberia hunting these like antelope that are the size of this water glass. You know, it's like, the whole fact that he is dealing with native trackers and they're calling them in, and it's, you know, it's impenetrable jungle in this, and this whole adventure, I guess. I mean, you know, it's maybe it sounds cliched, but how many adventures are there left? I'm sure there, you know, there's plenty of them, but I mean, also it kind of seems to me that more and more people are kind of like, adventure's becoming more and more kind of a stunt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And that when I went to, I came at the very, 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 very end of when going to Africa was an adventure because it was Africa. And you didn't have to be, it wasn't a stunt to find adventure in Africa. It was there, you know?
Just by the fact of being there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, it's interesting, you mentioned the, that story about that, the guy, that hunter, we took a mutual disliking to, but so this
meaning that you and me took a mutual dislike.
I know he and I took a mutual dislike to each other.
Got any final thoughts, Giannis?
Got a lot of final questions.
Sure,
we don't have to, probably time for, but
pick one.
Pick one.
Pick your best one. Take your best shot.
Attention must be paid.
I've got this all the classic. I just want to start talking calibers and bullet weights.
Oh, that's what your problem is?
Yeah, because that's like
375.
Like, I mean, I like the bigger grinder right, ideas.
I'll break
too,
it down for you.
But Tom and I 425
Nitro Express is what a lot.
470. 470 is awfully nice.
Tom and I could probably sit around now after.
That's what you wanted out of this?
You guys left.
Yeah, Yanni's podcast, which.
Yeah. I'm going to ask what his favorite caliber was over 40 years and how that changed.
Well, you should have told me earlier, man.
375. You can't go wrong. You can't go wrong in Africa with a 375.
Well, I'll tell you the name. I'll tell you, just to let you know that I'm adept.
Mm-hmm.
The Queens of the Plains rifles. Isn't that something like that? The Queen of the Plains rifles.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Queen, yeah.
375 is about...
All right, so Giannis is bummed out that we didn't...
No, I'm not at all. I'm just saying that, like, you know, as we're discussing all these controversial ideas, I'm thinking,
okay,
like, oh,
when you're getting ready to go,
wonder if he hand-loaded most of his ammunition.
Okay, when you're getting ready to go...
As a matter of fact, I did, but that's beside the point.
When you're getting ready to go, text Tom and ask him what...
Yeah, I will.
Michelle,
And Woodley solids, by the way, are good for you.
Yeah. So I know these landscapes are like, when I think of fenced hunts, all I know of is our recent discussion with, you know, talking about CWD, right?
Yep.
And I know the landscape is on such a greater scale over in Africa, but in these fenced areas, is there any problem with disease transmission?
Well, that's a good question. And it's, you know, I think in the afterword to the book, I kind of look into the fact of that. You know, you have this, you have one school of thought that says by getting value out of the wildlife, we're actually helping to preserve it by these ranches down there. But at the same time, they're also doing these bizarre breeding programs so they can come up with golden wildebeest.
Yeah.
Or black impalas, and which they have now found out that they're all sterile. You know, I mean, it's like a
the management paradox.
Really, yeah. like dozens of species of big game isn't enough.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I mean, they want to be able to, you know, oh well, you don't have one of these. You know, they want to be able to buttonhole a guy at a hunting convention.
Make that money.
You don't have one of these in your wall. Like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I'll get one of. Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, it's just, and then you know, there's a whole argument about that. But as I point out in that essay, it's the same thing that happened in Spain. When Spain went, you know, went crazy with all this money, everybody wanted to have Andalusian horses.
Mm-hmm.
Then they all went broke. And then the horses, they just left to starve. You know, they, they had no money to run the hostancias anymore, and they just took off and left them. So like right now they're saying, well, look at all the money we can make out of these animals, and we can it's a bubble. It's a bubble, and it's going to – and then what happens? I don't know.
Yeah. And disease may be one of those factors or
– Well, it sounds like they shoot animals there. Like in this book, you refer to – and I don't want to open up a whole new thing, but risks of wildlife – well, same thing with brucellosis. And they don't want – like shooting animals to prevent disease transmission to livestock.
Yeah, they've actually. I mean, that's what they've again found out is that they're. You were talking about the map of how much non-supplemental feeding of cattle and how much land there is. Well, it's even worse in South Africa. I mean, there's most of the land is really pretty poor agricultural land. So there is that argument that at least the wildlife is adapted to the land, and we can make some money off of that, and then we don't have. I don't know what else you'd do with the land over there, but. You know, you can, you know, it just becomes, you're chasing your own, your dog chasing its tail. I don't know. I mean, I you know, it these public, I mean, the you know, the fact that these guys are going to auctions and spending $2 million for a buffalo to put into their breeding stock.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm.
Because they think the genes are going to, there's no guarantee the genes are going to do anything.
Yeah, you have a real concluding thought?
Did you ever hunt any small game over there in 40
yeah,
years?
A lot. Yeah, Franklin grouse.
That's like kind of that's like the quintessential small game, right? Everybody goes, like almost everybody like hunts in Franklin, right?
Or sand grouse. Sand grouse are tough. They usually wait until like about 10 minutes after sunset to come to the water hole, you know, and they're just streaking in there. And that's, you know, they're just harder than hell to kill.
Throw them another one, Yanni. That's why you get all this out of your system so you feel like you weren't wasting your time here.
Oh, I don't.
Hand load, he was shooting hand loads. Mm-hmm. He likes 375.
Solids.
Hunt some small game.
Solid. Well, solids.
Do you hunt squirrels?
Yeah, I hunted squirrels, but not in Africa.
Well, he likes to talk about squirrels, too.
I like it when you put the stick up in the tree and they twist it.
Good old Kevin Murphy.
Twisting the squirrel out of the tree.
Yep.
Yeah. A wounded one. Yeah.
Oh well, those are the worst kind.
You good?
No, I can come up with plenty. So you never were in a dangerous position with a Cape Buffalo. How about any other animal? Were you ever actually thinking?
Sue Scrofa. Yeah, wild boar. I had a wild, yeah. That was the only, I think, out-and-out charge I ever saw, and it kind of veered off for me and went towards this other guy, was actually a wild boar, which is the least, you know, African.
Yeah, all that crazy shit, it's a wild boar.
Yeah, well, that's, you never know. That's the one that, you know, you never hear the bullet that kills you, right? That's
what. Well, you know, Capstick said, what was it, the dangerous thing he ever encountered was the woman on the malaria drugs, right?
Petey? My friend Petey?
Yeah. Is that the name of the story?
No.
I can't remember.
No, Pete was a friend of mine.
Oh.
And God love him. He was a wonderful raconteur.
Yeah, you talk about malaria pills too.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's Larium, I think, is the, it's a great psychedelic drug to take when you're sleeping because you get these like just full-blown dreams.
Dude, I disagree because I could see when I'm on that, I could see waking up and like realizing that you're sucking on the end of a pistol. It's that bad for my brain.
You've had Larium problems?
Yeah, I react like, yeah.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, I'll take the malaria.
Yeah, no, I
if I have to choose between that drug and that disease, I'll take the disease.
it's bad stuff for some people. Really bad stuff for some people. But yeah.
All right, man.
All right.
Well, August in Africa.
Thank you so much.
I'm guessing people can buy this book on Amazon.
Yeah. The other book, my novella, is the Snow Leopard's Tale. And that's also available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all your finer, online outlets.
Yeah, if you're curious, if you hate African hunting, if you love it, if you might want to go, it'll inform your perspectives in a non-manipulative way. Thanks for joining us, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.